Campus FM presents Treasures from Malta. This episode was originally recorded for the Treasures from Malta podcast series, produced by Fondazione Patrimonio Malti. Hello and welcome to Treasures from Malta, a podcast series produced by Fondazione Patrimonio Malti. I am Francesca Balsan, an art historian and an artist with a long connection with Patrimonio. I'll be presenting this podcast and meeting some of Malta's living treasures. These treasures are artists, historians or art collectors with some Malta connection. They're all fair game for the pod and we want to share them with you. My guest today is a ceramic artist who is working clay in exciting, radical new ways. From his undergrad days at MCAST in Malta to finishing top of his class at the Royal College of Art in 2019, he has continually excelled. In the short space of a few years, he has won numerous prestigious awards and scholarships. He is represented by major galleries and has already exhibited in craft fairs where his work was singled out for praise. His name is now synonymous with 3D printing, but his work is rooted in tradition and Malta's historical legacy, producing incredibly beautiful porcelain vessels that have this timeless, calm quality to them and an elegance that is classical. Nico Conti, welcome to the podcast.
Hi, Francesca. Thank you very much. Thanks for the lovely introduction and for also inviting me to be part of this series.
Nico, where are you speaking to us from?
So I'm currently in my home in London. I thought about, you know, like whether I should answer this call from my studio to be more sort of in the zone. But I thought, you know, like I share my space with four other ceramicists and it wouldn't be a very quiet place for me to do that. So yeah, I'm from my home, the other part of London. It's in Richmond and hope it's much more quiet than my studio would be.
Can you tell me a bit about what attracted you to ceramics in the first place and where did you learn this art form?
Yeah, so I think I'm very lucky. I've had very great upbringing and I was never pushed in any specific direction when it came to career. And my parents, I think my mother mostly, she really supported my artistic abilities and she did send me to private art lessons. But I never really wanted to pursue art as a career for the longest time. I ran away from it as much as possible and I studied programming. I studied some languages as well and also looked into architecture. But in the end, you know, like they were not very, they lacked certain creativity for me. And I decided to go and study at MCAST and did fine arts there. And during my last year of MCAST, I was working on my dissertation and I discovered clay, more specifically porcelain. I was reading this book by Edmond de Waal called The White Road and it talks about these transformative qualities of clay, how you have this when it's not fired, you know, it's like this soft, dusty material, very fragile, breaks easily. But after adding the simple element of fire to it, it completely transforms it, changing it into this very clean material that we're, you know, it's synonymous with eating from it. But also used for decorative purposes such as vases. And, with little knowledge, but sort of lots of determination, I applied for RCA, Royal College of Art, and I got accepted. And it was so intimidating in the beginning, but, you know, it's here now.
Of course. Nico, I imagine it's quite competitive to be accepted there, no?
It is quite competitive, yes. It's currently the number one art school in the world, and it has been like that for a number of years. And the acceptance rate is, I'm not sure what it is, but it's very competitive.
Simply on the basis of practically 1 year of learning how to use clay, already you were accepted to the RCA, which is an indication that you had already achieved a level of quality in your work and you were displaying art in the way you worked in clay. You mentioned Edmond de Waal, who I am a great fan of, but we'll come to him later and we'll find out later what he said about you. Okay, so you've made a name for yourself with beautiful, incredibly intricate ceramics that no potter or sculptor would be able to do using just his fingers or manual tools only. Now, you are pushing currently the boundaries of ceramics, and this is only possible with the use of technology and computers and printing. You are, in fact, one of the leading exponents of 3D printing in ceramics. Now, at what stage did you get interested in 3D printing? And what is it that attracts you to this new way of doing ceramics?
I think that's a good question. I never really, you know, like asked this question for myself, but it's good that I get to talk about it. I was always digitally savvy, so I all, even before fine arts, I did programming, as I said. But I felt that it was not creative in a very materialistic way. And I abandoned the programming completely. And at the end of my first year at the Royal College of Art, we got 2 3D printing machines, and no one really used it. And the first time I tried to use it as well, I found it very boring, because you gave a design to a computer and it almost created like a very similar or exact replica of that design. And there was also this taboo about craft and technology. So I was very scared to merge the two together. However, I decided to try it again, and I was working on this very simple piece, and I left it alone for maybe 5 minutes. And when I came back and saw the piece, an error happened, and it started printing in a very unusual way, I would say. So rather than how it normally would print, which is very linear, it started going all loopy. And I was so interested in this idea of failure that I wanted to utilize it. And from then onwards, I focused my second year of RCA to really explore this idea of technology, failure, and craft, and merge the three together in a harmonious manner.
When we talk about 3D printing, essentially, as opposed to normal printing that we do on our home computer and home printer, which is printing out on a sheet of paper, so two-dimensionally, 3D printing enables you to create an object. You actually end up with an object which is three-dimensional. So let's say I take an egg cup, I scan it, put it up on computer, and the printer will print the exact replica of the egg cup. Is that correct?
Yeah, it can function quite similarly to how you explained. Essentially, in the most simplest term that I can think of, 3D printing, like normal printing, works on 2 axes. It goes up and it goes down, and it follows this outline of sorts. In many cases, the outline is text or an image. But when it comes to 3D printing, rather than focusing on 2 axes, it also goes up. So it prints, rather than just printing following an outline in 2 dimensions, it follows it in the 3rd dimension as well.
So let's take that and frame it within your whole process. Of course, you are creating objects out of clay, and you're firing them at the end. Can you run us through the whole process of, you know, thinking up an object, and when you finally get to hold the finished product in your hand, what is the process?
Yeah, it is a very, very long process, actually. And there's often this misconception that you just press a button and the magic is done and you end up with this object. And there is the pressing of the button involved, but it's like a very small part of the whole process. So I start with the concept of the object, basically, what I want to create. And because I work with technology, I really look at traditional forms to basically try to honor the past by using something of the future. And I do this by going to the V&A quite a lot. I think I get most of my inspiration from there. And for each design that I create on a computer, I use around 4 different programs for modeling and slicing. So modeling would be me actually sculpting the object on a computer. So essentially, I have digital clay. And slicing would be me giving the computer a command that slices the 3D object into various layers. And this is basically telling the machine to print one layer, go up by 1 millimeter, and print the second layer. So it's this buildup of various layers that create the object. And finally, I sometimes process the clay by my hands to give it a more organic feel. And I also try to put in glitches in my programming part of it, which sort of balances the consistency with something quite unpredictable. And after I process the clay and finish the design, I fire it to 1,300 degrees. And what happens here is that the porcelain vitrifies, essentially clay becoming almost like glass and has a light sheen to it. And it allows lots of light through it as well. So yeah, it's a very, very long process to get an object, essentially.
Do you do some finishing after that?
Very minimal finishing. Sometimes the base needs to be sanded down, but I try to do as much work as possible before the firing, so I won't disturb or disrupt the objects too much.
In fact, they appear to be incredibly fragile, very, very thin walled and very intricate in pattern.
Yeah, they look very fragile, but recently I've been sending my work abroad. I sent work to South Korea, America, and Canada, and they've all survived. And I've really been thinking about how I can give the impression that they're fragile, but essentially they're quite strong.
Of all the clays that you could work in, you always seem to favor porcelain, which is beautiful and, of course, translucent, as you've mentioned, if you work it thinly enough. But it's also incredibly challenging as a clay. It's perhaps one of the hardest clays to work with because it flops and it's very, very fine. Why porcelain in particular?
Yeah, I think I can go back to Edmond de Waal's book, The White Road. He talks about porcelain so poetically. I think everyone who will read it will want to try to use porcelain at least once. And I think the trick with porcelain is to work with it, not against it. You know, like, I really understand the material I work with now. I use a type of very white porcelain. It's imported from Australia. And it allows so much light through it that the pieces, essentially, if they're put in a windowsill, they can transform completely. I'm very aware that sort of porcelain is also a limited resource and it does take a toll on the environment. So recently, you know, I've been recycling all the things that I don't use, and I'm very aware and not to waste or fire anything that would not survive otherwise.
Of course, you've already explained all of this to His Royal Highness, the Prince of Wales, when he visited the RCA some years ago, and you were tasked with explaining your whole process to him. Now, what was his reaction to it?
Yeah, I think before his reaction, I'll explain a bit sort of the backstory. So at college, we often got VIPs there, but they're usually CEOs of big companies and people who worked with clay. And because of the novelty of 3D printing, I was also picked to present to them. And so it wasn't sort of really a surprise the day before. I was told a VIP was coming, but they didn't say who it was. And around 5 minutes of before my presentation, I saw lots of armed security, like fully armed with dogs, like around college. And I thought, who's this person? And then as I'm printing, the machine stopped working and I was really panicking. And then I saw him coming down the stairs. I used an old print that I've made and I've put it there. I pretended that that was the print that was printing and I was all flustered, but he came and he introduced himself and he was so sweet to me. He was very kind. It's like talking to an uncle almost, if that makes sense. And because I was very worried. He's a traditionalist. He likes to preserve craft. He champions older craft, but he really understood and appreciated what I did. And I explained about how it's important for me to keep clay exciting for future generations as well. Like everything, craft evolves as well, and it's good to keep it going, keep it in a constant flux and keep it moving. And yeah, I mean, the talk was supposed to be just 30 seconds, but it lasted for over 10 minutes and people in the background were asking me to stop, you know, but I decided to ignore them just that once.
Good for you. I mean, how can you reduce your whole process and all your research to 30 seconds, for goodness sake? But I love that you fed him fake news, that you told him. So your machine went on the blink,
yeah.
Right then,
yeah.
As machines do. They're just as bad as us humans. How young is 3D printing in clay specifically? I mean, my understanding is that it has only been possible for less than a decade, you know, less than 10 years. And as far as I know, few ceramic artists have engaged with it so far. And were you actually taught 3D printing in clay specifically? Or was it something you had to teach yourself using the machines that were not really being used at the RCA?
Okay, so there are various methods of 3D printing in clay. And the clay, as we know it, the 3D printing as we know it now, it started in the industry maybe in the early 2000s, but it was used for medical and industrial uses only. And later on, like you've said, in the last 10 years, companies have been really exploring this and delivering them to schools more than individual use. The thing is that there's not much, they're quite expensive machines, and there's not much companies making them, so the price remains high. So that's why maybe not as many people as there should be using them. Mm-hmm. And for me, I did have an induction on how to use the machine at Royal College. I've had 1 week induction where we experimented a bit, we designed something simple, but it's mostly self-taught through lots of experimentation. And I also looked at what others before me did, and I was like, I really want to learn from them, but I want to learn from them by doing the opposite. You know, they wanted to perfect things, they wanted mm-hmm. to make things that had perfect structure. I wanted things that collapsed, things that looked organic or belonging to nature.
You know, I just kept thinking on about what you said about kind of technology and craft, and how it's almost frowned upon to bring in technology into craft because craft is so prized for being handmade and unique and all that. But looking at your wonderful, really beautiful vessels and pots and designs that you create, those would just never have been possible in a traditional craft context. It's just impossible to do them by hand. You need a printer to do something like that. Is that correct? Or at a stretch, if you spend hundreds of hours, you could possibly do it by hand?
No, you would never be able to do something like this by hand. And essentially, it's another tool that we use to be able to create something new, you know, like when the wheel came around, before that there was hand building, right? And with hand building, you would never achieve the sort of perfection that a wheel gives you, or in a certain amount of time at least. And the same with 3D printing. It really is not a competitor to any other medium. It's just a completely new way to use a material.
Absolutely. Now, the fact that you can repeat the printing of a design, so you've got a design that you've created, that's unique, you've created it on computer, but you can print it twice, 3 times, 300 times, the problem becomes uniqueness then. Do you still consider the resulting fired object unique? And do you impose a limit on how many times you will print a design so that you, let's say, if you're selling your finished object to a collector, can you put their mind at rest that you're not going to print another 200?
In the programming side, I also put sort of a few glitches in it, meaning that there's this concept of something unpredictable, like the outcome will be unpredictable. And even if I print the same object twice, which in some cases I did when an object is a pair, mm-hmm. and I want to make two of it, the end result, even though maybe the form would be similar, the pattern would be completely different from one another.
Okay.
Because there are so many small variables that come into play that change this. However, all my big work, unless they're a pair, as I've mentioned, I print it once, and after that I destroy the file. And that's it. You know, if I tell the person that there will only be one of it, I won't make another one. And there are cases where I make small pieces and I make a limited edition of 10. So my smaller urchins, they're not one-offs. And the idea behind them is that the file takes so long to make, but the printing doesn't. And like that, I can sort of lower the price down. And it also helps to deliver my work and be able to reach a collector who doesn't want to maybe spend as much as having a unique item, which takes much, much longer to create one of from.
So you mentioned that you actually destroy the design in cases where you want to have one-offs. Okay, I admire your ethical standards and the fact that you never want it to be repeated. But it's a bit sad for me because it's like you're destroying the bozzetto, if I make an analogy with traditional art, with painting, for example. You know, you have the original drawing and then you have the painting, although the two are completely separate. But do you destroy it before or after the firing?
After the firing, definitely, after the firing. And when I'm sure that I just want one of it, because sometimes I make an object and I like it on its own, but I really think that it would make sense that it's a pair. And in some cases as well, someone bought one and they want it as a pair, so they would commission the second exact one like it. And I explain that I'd be able to achieve the same size, the same form, but the pattern will be completely different because of the glitches I put in. And so I do destroy it after I made the sale, actually.
Okay, all right. What about clever you? So we mentioned flaws and glitches, but also collapse and ruin and the accidental. And although your vessels have this timeless serenity to them that I mentioned, you're actually interested in these things that can go wrong and how, in a way, these can enhance and the artwork and make it unique. Now, tell me a bit more about that. And what I really want to know is it because you're Nico Conti from Malta, it's your Mediterranean wild streak that's showing through this perfect predictability of computer programs?
Yeah, I think I'm the opposite of wild. I don't know what that would be, but I do.
Tame.
Yeah, I'm very tame as a person, I think. But I do consider myself to be a perfectionist, actually. I like things where I have full control over them. But artworks, I think, made in that mindset can get boring very quickly. And not just for the viewers, but also for me. And I always make things that I enjoy making, things that surprise me, things that I don't have full control of. And I think my best works and lessons always start from a failure. And I'm always interested in taking this failure and try to utilize it and transform it into something beautiful or something successful.
That is where you are an artist, because in this conversation, I know you describe yourself as a ceramic artist, but as this conversation evolves, I'm thinking of you more and more as a computer programmer, because really half the work, if not more, is done on computer, on screen. Of course, it involves art and it involves originality and it involves a very strong sense of design and beauty as well. But essentially, would you identify as being a digital artist?
I've never thought about that. I wouldn't really know. I would say no, maybe, because I strive to achieve an end result, which is a material object. So I see myself more as being a material artist. But I cannot really exclude that most, if not more, of my work is done in a computer. So I don't know, maybe a mixture of both.
I'm just thinking of the tips of your fingers. Where are your fingers? In the clay or on the keyboard?
Both, actually. I think it's also very hands-on when 3D printing something. And with some pieces, I manipulated the clay as it's being printed out as well.
I see.
So the way printing happens is that, because I didn't explain this part, there is a big cylinder tube that is attached to an air compressor, and the air compressor pushes out the tube from a very fine nozzle. And as the printer moves, the nozzle leaves a trail of clay behind.
It's like piping a design onto a cake, in a way.
Exactly, yeah. Sometimes when something is too perfect, I nudge it a bit, you know, and I press my hands in it and I try to make it collapse sometimes.
Nico, you've been spotted even before graduating and you were included in a number of prestigious publications on contemporary arts and ceramics. In fact, your name first came up. I first sort of noticed you through these international magazines, actually. And your pieces have been described as very, very beautiful work by Edmond de Waal, who is perhaps the most important and celebrated ceramicist in the art world at the moment. I mean, you yourself are saying how his books have influenced you. He's also, of course, an award-winning author, and one of his most famous publications is The Hair with the Amber Eyes, which a lot of our listeners will have read. He was totally enthusiastic about your work. How does that feel? I mean, is it a spur to continue to work on that path?
Yeah, I think when he talked about my work, it felt like a full circle. So I started doing ceramics a few years ago, just after reading his books. So to really, you know, like a few years ago, not having ever touched porcelain, to now him, who I admire so much, described my work as beautiful. It was so validating for me. And it's not just about his work now that I sort of know him more and know his work more. It's about the positive way that he has impacted ceramics and how he elevated craft into this fine art world almost. And that I admire so much. And I think that validation for me was very important. It was one, it was in the middle of the pandemic where I set up my space and I could not really, you know, like go and make work. And being an artist, there's so much sacrifice and so much was happening at that time, shows being cancelled, shows being moved online. But his comment really kept me going, really kept me excited about the future and to produce more work.
Let's take a break. And in the meantime, our listeners should have a look through your Instagram page, which is full of these beautiful works. Because really, I cannot convey how lovely your work is. It has to be seen. This episode, originally recorded for the Treasures from Malta podcast series and now being broadcast on Campus FM, is a conversation between me, Francesca Balzan, and my guest, ceramicist Nico Conti. And we're back. Don't forget to go to our podcast page on www.patrimonio.org to see pictures and links to what we've discussed in each podcast episode. So, Nico, you say that you are inspired by the traditional Maltese crafts of lace and filigree. Now, I agree that your pots and vessels are incredibly intricate, but not very obviously refer to patterns of filigree and lace, because those tend to be a bit more freeform and varied within the same object. So can you explain how you are inspired by these Maltese crafts and how you manage to produce art, which actually has a very contemporary vibe to it?
Yes, I try to capture the essence of them. So it's more like a memory of lace or a memory of my mother's intricate wedding gown. So it's how I remember it from the pictures rather than trying to copy an exact replica. In fact, I have a few examples of porcelain and filigree in my studio, and I use them to admire their ornate, intricate detail more than a direct copy of them. And I think, yeah, with filigree, it's the same as well. With filigree, there's this sense of an object forming with little abstract shapes of silver wire. And essentially, that's what I do. You know, I'm taking a strand of porcelain and really molding it into creating this object.
Now, I love this quote of yours that, for me, seems to say it all. You say, in my work, I experiment with different processes of clay 3D printing, transforming the uniformity of it and ultimately pushing clay to unexplored territories. By embracing the tradition and heritage that surrounded my upbringing, my work is autobiographical at its core. Now, the word autobiographical keeps coming up in relation to you, Nico, and indeed your RCA thesis was titled Reflections on White, an Autobiographical Exploration. What is autobiographical about your work?
Growing up in Malta, very few things were white to me. We don't have snow. Our stone has a yellow tint to it. The strong sun leaves a yellow tint on everything. So things that were white to me really, really stood out. So there's one time I saw a white peacock and I was blown away at its sort of beauty. And there's also, you know, my grandma used to breed rabbits and I had this admiration for white rabbits. And as I've mentioned before, the white wedding dress. However, white is also related to obsession. And this runs in our family with cleaning, obsession of cleaning. my great grandma used to go through 3 bottles of bleach every day. So she, you know, and this runs in my mother as well. So she has a full-time job and we have a big house and she cleans it every day before she goes to work. She wakes up 2 hours before and cleans the house. So this idea of white and cleanliness is very evident in me growing up as a child. And white also stands out, and it's not always in a good way. Actually, it's rarely in a good way. Like an example in my mind is that I was reading about the painter James Whistler, and when he came to London, he first noticed how dirty, poor, and smelly the people of London were compared to America. And in sort of response to that, he created his Woman in White series, and he exhibited in a full white exhibition space. Because before that, exhibition space used to be quite ornate. And he did so people can self-reflect and really compare themselves to the whiteness and see how dirty they actually were. So it was, the white was quite menacing. However, my white, when I say it's autobiographical, it's not in this sort of menacing way. It's more an amalgamation of my childhood, my memories, my obsession with perfection. But it's also has elements of imperfection in it. So, also a message of me letting go, allowing myself to be more free.
Perhaps your fingerprint isn't necessarily in the clay, but your soul is in it.
That's correct.
Now, again, looking through your body of work, at least what I was able to see online, most of the work you've done is either in white or black, or at maximum, like maybe single colors. So you don't actually exploit colors all that much. You don't mix them on the same object. Why is that?
I never glaze my work because I like how porcelain looks when it is vitrified. It creates this beautiful sheen that I feel that glaze, because I use 3D printing, which is often associated with plastics. But when it has this glossy texture, my work transforms from clay to almost plastic looking, and I really try to avoid it as much as possible. And when it comes to color, I do experiment a little, but I always go back to white. And all my work before has been white, even before I've done ceramics. I have this sort of liking to how porcelain really allows the detail to come through, how much light it allows through. And I feel like adding color to it really, in most cases, just hinders from the simplicity and the beauty of the shape and the texture.
And black?
I have some black pieces. I really wanted to experiment with black, and I mix my own black clay. I use black iron oxide, cobalt oxide, and manganese oxide, all to give it that very dark black matte color. And I do like how earthy, how matte it is, but I still tend to prefer the white. I think it's just personal preference, about mostly because it allows so much light through it, the white, that any other additive would be completely really, diminishing the beauty of porcelain.
So light is almost a medium for you as well.
Yeah, for sure. I think I like to photograph my work in the natural sunlight. I do have studio photography, but I like the ones that look more natural in a domestic setting.
The light in Malta is very different to the light in London, of course, the natural light. Has studying and living in London affected your work?
It has definitely affected my work, I would say. I think, and even in terms of resources, all the access to the museums. I've mentioned the Victoria and Albert Museum before, and the connections, the people I've met, and the conversations I've had here about 3D printing. And I would be doing 3D printing if I didn't come and study abroad. I think my practice is here because of a very lucky sort of pattern that I followed. And I got 3D printing at the perfect time and no one was using it. And I was very lucky. I had a happy accident with it. So yeah, I think if I wasn't here, I wouldn't be able to do that. And here I get to meet other makers, people I admire. And before, I just saw their images online. So that really helped me. Having said that, you know, I think that even though London has affected my work, Malta still remains very close to my heart. And that's where I draw my inspiration from, mostly from the memories of my childhood. Yeah.
And yet you also cite architecture as an influence, and I see a lot of the tracery of Gothic architecture in your work. At least I see some sort of parallels there. And that presumably is what you're seeing in England, at least even in the books you see, and it's more akin to British architecture rather than Maltese, because we have very few examples of, in our case, neo-Gothic in Malta.
Yeah, that's good that you've mentioned it. I grew up in Paula, and we have the cemetery there,
which does follow
Gothic architecture, as far as I know. And I was always interested about sort of the intricate details of it all. And yeah, I think maybe I've drawn some inspiration from there. I don't know, not directly for sure, but possibly so.
Who are the ceramicists and artists whose work inspires you?
Yeah, I think my influence varies so much. One example would be, I really love Magdalena Adondu's work. She's a Kenyan-born British potter, and British-based potter, sorry. And she does hand building, and she burnishes these black and orange, beautiful, natural-colored vessels. And in that case, I like her connection to nature. They're so well made, so finely made, and I just admire her work so much. And also Takuro Kuwata, who's a Japanese ceramic artist, and he makes very colorful pieces of dripping and oozing glazes, and they're so fun and so opposite of what I would normally and intrinsically do, you know, that I just love it completely. And of course, Edmond Duval, I think I've mentioned him, and just the simplicity and how he displays his work, how he curates his work, and how he talks about work as well. So I think those three would be it. They're all ceramicists. I love ceramics so much. There are other artists, but these are my main three ones.
But Nico, you also teach ceramics. Tell me about this aspect of your practice.
Yeah, so I did some tutoring in the UK and Denmark. So like, I wouldn't say I really sort of teach, but I did help some students with 3D printing. And even though that it's not my current profession, I really enjoy it. There's this reward of satisfaction when you help someone with making art. And yeah, I think I often get told, mostly by friends and even my mother, you know, like, don't give all your secrets away, you know, like, don't show them all your tricks. But, you know, for me, I don't really care about that. I see 3D printing as this new way of making, new way of, like, expressing oneself, you know, and just like the wheel I've mentioned before, just a means to an end. So I share all my secrets, I share all my tricks, but at the end result is always so different than what I make. And for me, I find that to be so exciting.
For sure, you're leading from the front here. And anyway, you're always a trick or a secret ahead of everybody else, because as an artist, you're always developing ideas. You must be building on your own work, and you must have ideas for future works, reacting to your previous work. So, but you've also won numerous prestigious awards and scholarships, including the 2019 France Rising Star Project and the Queen Elizabeth Scholarship Trust Scholarship, and a place at Cockpit Arts. Now, can you tell me about them, and what do they mean to you?
Yeah, I think there are many opportunities for makers, especially in craft. It's so popular now, I would say more popular than ever. And I try to use every platform I can to share my work with others. And competitions and awards are a good way of getting recognition and possibly even, you know, like, experience as well. And it's all with competitions, I find that it's such a great way to test out new concepts like designs or ideas, because most of them, even if you don't get in, they give you some sort of feedback. And not being in college anymore, like, I don't really get constructive feedback. So for me, it's so important that I get feedback from other external sources. And at the moment, yes, I'm working on a project with the Queen Elizabeth Trust Scholarship, and it's a project in Wales. I'm working with an old factory. It's called Nangaru China Works, And this factory started 200 years ago, but it closed after 10 years. They claimed that they produced the whitest porcelain on the planet, but it's so difficult to work with that they went bankrupt after a while. And the pieces that remain these days are amongst the most prized porcelain pieces. And they recreated the clay recipe. Mm-hmm. And they've asked me to actually 3D print with it. And even though at the moment I'm currently working on it and it's proving to be quite challenging, it is a very, very fun project. And to be using a 200-year-old recipe, I think it's so interesting, so fun.
Incredible. What about Cockpit Art?
Yeah, Cockpit Arts is a studio that focuses on artist incubation. And there are over 200 artists that are split into two facilities in London. And it's such a great platform. They've given me a free studio space and a kiln for 1 year. And because of the pandemic, they extended it for 2 years. So this way, they allowed me to really keep on experimenting with my work and not worry too much about finances, maybe, and be able to push my boundaries. And in the 2.5 years now that I've been there, my work has truly evolved. It has become more ambitious. And yes, I'm very thankful for that. And with France Rising Star, that was the first competition I applied as soon after I graduated. And it was so important for me to really do something after I graduated. It's very tricky when you do well at college and then everything stops afterwards. You're never really prepared for the real life. Mm. And that competition was huge ego boost for me to really continue and pursue my passion for making.
I bet. Now, spill the beans. Any major collections that collect you?
Yeah, so actually, my work mostly has gone to private collectors. There was one time me trying to work on a commission, but then the pandemic happened and everything fell down, you know. But I think my work mostly goes to private collectors, and if they're in the UK, I always try to deliver the work by hand, because some of the houses, you know, like, are usually like museums of artworks, and I've seen, you know, like my work being displayed like next to Picasso or Tracy Emin's neon lights, and I always find that so fun, you know. And even other houses that are sort of simpler or more lived in, I still enjoy seeing them, about how people display my work and how really, you know, like, transforms it into something quite different.
You're being very discreet, and rightly so, and you're not mentioning these collections. Well done, you. But what about our national collection, Musa? Do they have one of your pieces?
No, they don't, actually.
So this is a gentle nudge. Perhaps they'll start collecting you as well.
Yes, Musa, please buy my work. Yeah. And yeah, I did. I sold work to Maltese collectors as well, but they're like private collectors, so like they're not tied to like any institution.
So what is your relationship with collectors? I mean, what about people commissioning work? Is that something you enjoy doing? And do you sort of draw ideas even from the person commissioning the work?
Yeah, I always try to keep in touch with people who collect my work. And I always have very interesting conversations with them. And they're usually very interested to see new work and new direction, because in a way, they're really investing in you. You know, like, I'm still at the beginning of my career, and they want to invest in something that they be, you know, and play a part in my growth as an artist. And I do occasionally work on commissions, but commissions can be a bit tricky. And the trickiest part would be to set realistic expectations, as, you know, some people forget that I'm working with clay and it has physical attributes and I have to follow certain physical laws and all, you know, I cannot, it's not magic. And so it's quite, you know, like if I can set realistic expectations and they want something that is within reason, then I do make commissions. And when I do so, I talk to the person, I ask where the piece would be shown, because that really helps me to put certain elements. If it's in a window, I can, you know, I can make it allow much more light through. But even if it's maybe in a darker spot, I can focus on the shadows more than the light, for example. So that really helps for me as an artist to make the piece fit the space specifically?
We talked about how craft is perhaps being better appreciated. And in the last 2 years, while people were increasingly spending time in their homes, it seems that there's this growing appreciation for the handmade, the well-made objects, not only to beautify and decorate the house, but also to use it, to just enjoy using beautiful objects in the home. Now, there is this newfound interest in handmade ceramics, both in actually doing hands-on ceramics and in acquiring pieces. And I would say that in the last 2 years, this art has generally flourished. Now, this is further aided by the big international fairs. For example, there was Collect, which was on at Somerset House in London just a few weeks ago, and Ceramic Art London, which is very, very recent, which was held at Central St. Martin's. Have you participated in these fairs, and are you seeing this increasing interest in ceramics by art collectors?
Yeah, I did participate in Collect these last 2 years. Last year it was online. There were a number of talks online. There was an online catalogue on a website called Artsy. But this year it was in person in Somerset House. And I got to go 3 times there with different people each time, as there was so much to take in. You know, like some said, it's too much just to enjoy for one day, you know? And you keep seeing new things every day, new artists every day. And yes, I find that to be so excited. And there were lots of ceramics there, but I also noticed a huge increase in textile art, which I did enjoy seeing in terms of quality. That you see the artists there. There are artists that are represented there every year. There are artists that are new, which I like, but also, you know, art that, you know, like I didn't really enjoy. I think it's a mixture of everything. But it's such a good place to be, a wonderful place. It's a beautiful building, but is also, you know, an interesting place to talk to people, talk with like-minded people.
But have you noticed this trend, that there's this increasing interest in acquiring ceramics?
Yeah, for sure. And ceramics, during the pandemic, you know, like people want to live with well-made objects, I feel. And like you've said, even maybe use them, like mugs. You've showed me the mug that you've got from Sumifsud earlier, and I'd like to, you know, like thank Sumifsud, because she really helped me with ceramics when I got the call from RCA. I phoned her panicking. I'm like, I need some ceramic lessons, you know, can you help me? And she kindly did, you know, so I'm very thankful for her. And so, yes, definitely people is increasing so much. And even we chose like the Great Pottery Throwdown, that it's becoming so popular. People have really wanted to try and work with ceramics. And even though the show sets very unrealistic expectations of ceramics and how it works, I think you can still get a good impression on how connected to the medium you are, on how with something so simple you can make something that's functional, something that's decorative.
Now, Nico, we've established that you've already done incredibly well and you've stood out from all the other ceramicists working in London at the moment. And you've got your whole life ahead of you. Now, where do you see yourself going with your ceramics?
Thank you very much. I would definitely love to scale up my work in one way or another. I would say my biggest piece is around 50 centimeters now. And I feel like I'm quite limited by the type of machinery that I have. So I cannot really go bigger. However, I do plan on working with other people maybe to try to build my own machine in the future. Essentially, it's not a very complex thing to build a machine. I think it's a matter of investing some time in it and be able to do it. And also, I want to move away from maybe more traditional forms such as the vases and vessels and go more in a sculptural direction. In Collect, I've had 2 pieces this year. One was fairly traditional, but the other one was 2 vases leaning on top of each other. And for me, even though that the subject matter is a vase, I saw it as more as a sculptural thing, because essentially a vase is something that has a function, right? It holds flowers. But with that, you know, it's almost collapsing, almost like a ruin or something that's discovered on archaeological sites.
Yes. And this is why I say that your work has a very contemporary vibe to it. Although perhaps the original inspiration, at least for the texture of it, is from filigree and lace. Ultimately, you're making very challenging pieces, even visually challenging, and visual puns, if you like, having these two vessels collapsing on top of each other, rendering the functional non-functional, is a bit of a sort of a visual irony. For me, that was extremely contemporary.
Thank you. Yes, I think I really sometimes punish myself, saying that maybe I owe the craft world something and try to remain doing traditional things because I use technology. But I think that piece for me was a piece that really allowed me to say, no, you know, like I'm just going to do what is going to push me forward, what is going to push me in a new direction. And for me, I enjoy doing that so much.
Excellent. I look forward to see what's next. Now, Nico, finally, I want to ask you to dream. No restrictions at all. What and where would be your dream exhibition to show your pieces?
Okay, so this is a bit tricky, but it has to be somewhere in Malta. So I've never shown my work in Malta ever. So my porcelain work has never been exhibited on the island I grew up in, which is such a pity and something that I want to do so much. And I have been thinking about setting up a show there for a couple of years now. I haven't really made any concrete plans, but I really want to do it. And my ideal location would be, I don't know, maybe like in a rundown or abandoned palace or house in Valletta. And it has to be structurally sound, of course, but I think the contrast of the two would be so interesting for me. And yeah, I don't know the location, but I think if you or any of the listeners do know, please do let me know. I'd be very much interested to do.
I've already listed around three ideas in my head. So
lovely.
Listen, Nico, this has been wonderful, and I'm sure, you know, I told you to dream, but you didn't dream all that big. So I'm sure it's completely doable, even over the next year. I would love to see your lovely porcelain vessels here in Malta against the Maltese sun. The quality of our light is totally different to that of London. We're going to see unexpected surprises, perhaps even visually as a result. But I must thank you for your time. I loved speaking with you. I can see a great passion for your medium, for your material. And it's going to be so exciting to see what you're going to come up with next.
Thank you very much, Francesca. And thank you for inviting me again. And for, you know, that, like this lovely conversation, it was so easygoing and flowing. I was dreading talking for like an hour, you know, but I truly enjoyed it, you know, and I wish it can go for longer. And maybe, you know, like in the future, we'll do like a part two or something. But fantastic. I really, really enjoyed it. Thank you so much.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Treasures from Malta on Campus FM. This was originally recorded as a podcast, and there are pictures and links to all we've discussed on the Fondazione Patrimonio Malti website under the podcast section. That's www.patrimonio.org.